People will talk. Welcome to the latest edition of the People Will Talk podcast. And today we have another interviewee, a very exciting one. We're talking to Bill Barker, who lives in Reading, England. And we're going to talk about lots of interesting things. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Enda. Nice to be here.
It's a pleasure having you here. And there are so many things that we can touch on. You mentioned being a bohemian, a writer. That's very interesting for me as well. And also your upbringing in a commune. But a feature of a lot of these interviews that we've done on the show with other people recently is that they have some kind of involvement with ESL teaching or TEFL, teaching English as a foreign language. And I myself have this background as well. So could you tell me a little bit about, you know, you used to live in Spain. How long were you there and what was your teaching experience like?
So I got involved in the TEFL game, the TEFL racket, whatever we call it, in my 20s. I saw it as a passage out of the UK, like a lot of people. And I know that there are a lot of people in TEFL that could be categorized as ne'er-do-wells or running away from something. There's certainly that element to it, and I was one of those. So I saw that as a way of seeing the world and getting out of the culture I was in. I thought it would make sense because I love words and I love the English language. So that's where it started. So like a lot of people, I did a TEFL certificate and that got me moving. And initially I went to Sardinia for a year. And that was an interesting experience. And then, I mean, it's an island, beautiful island and wonderful nature, etc. But very, very remote and quite quiet. And so after a year, I fancied something a bit more urban. So I headed to Madrid and then spent quite a few years coming and going, working on a variety of programs, etc.
Very nice. So you've been to Italy and Spain, two great TEFL destinations. Now, a lot of people might, if they're not familiar with TEFL, they might think, oh, it's something you do as a bit of a DOS sometimes, but it's actually quite hard work. And you found as well that it can be an intense working experience, no, teaching English to a classroom full of students.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to personality types in the end. There are some people that do it quite willingly. And they do it, they can teach all day and move from class to class and somehow leave it unscathed. But I always felt that it was very, very intense, you know, every hour, just the psychic exchange, all the psychological management going on. And I suppose also this kind of need to uphold a veneer of being a sort of professional teacher. And for me, I mean, it's not part of my personality to guide people or instruct them or lead them or anything like that. So it was always, you know, like when I came off out of a class, I felt I was coming off stage. So I found it exhausting. And so 4 hours teaching for me is just utterly, you know, soul destroying, really. Although necessarily, after many years doing it, I got very competent at it and could do it, but I still would never choose to do it.
I think you said something very interesting there. You feel like you're coming off stage. I've always felt that as well. There's a performative element to teaching. You're not just teaching a class, you're running a show in a sense as well. And I think you could have a perfect lesson plan as well, and then somebody comes up with a question that you hadn't anticipated, and you're like stuck sometimes thinking, what's the answer here? But I did hear a great trick from a trainer before, a teacher trainer, that if you don't know how to answer a question, you just tell them, that's your homework. Come back to me next class with the answer for that, which buys you a bit of time as well to find the answer.
Yeah, I think that probably works. I think you can use the old politician's trick and say, well, I think the real question is, and then twist it around to something that you want to say. Well, it's always difficult dealing with people, isn't it? And you never know what you're going to get. And you never know what mood people are going to be in. And you never know what the feel, the dynamic of the class, the chemistry of people working together is going to be. And somehow everything's channeled through you and you've got to make it work. And it's probably a lot harder than people realize, you know, because I think often on the other end, the customer just thinks that you're someone who knows a lot about English and it's simple. You just go in and tell people about English. But once you've had any training in it, I mean, there's so much more to it.
That's a very good point as well, because it's not just about having the ability to speak English, because you mentioned something as well about loving language. So maybe you came into the teaching job, knowing what a verb is and what a compound adjective is, or, you know, these different structures. When I entered the teaching game, some of those things I knew, but I knew how to write. I was a writer and still am a writer, but I didn't know the names and the mechanics of the language. And I was even watching a YouTube thing last week where quite a famous guy, you know, was helping his kids with homework and didn't know what these things were. So like when you came into the teaching job, did you kind of have a great foundation in knowing the mechanics of the English language and the things that, you know, other people coming into it might have to learn on the job, essentially?
I at a very young age, I was fascinated by grammar. And I think I was about 14 when I was reading these old tomes about English grammar and the King's English, etc. And I remember one spring, actually, I read the first one and I was utterly absorbed. You know, it was a whole new world. And I couldn't put it down. And then I subsequently read loads and loads about grammar. So when I eventually did my TEFL course, I pretty much knew all that. You know, I knew the basics, and I knew some of the obscure stuff, like, you know, the ergative, passive, etc. And that element of it is always going to be interesting. You know, and you either like it or you don't, I guess.
That's brilliant.
I know that generally, I think perhaps our generation, we didn't learn grammar at school. I think somewhere in the 70s or something, education, at least in the UK, became very postmodern, and it wasn't about rules and it wasn't about grammar. It was about just expressing what you felt. So I didn't have any formal grammar at school, and maybe you didn't either.
Not really, to be honest. Only if we were learning Irish, we learned the grammar of the language, or French. But since we did everything in English, we just really didn't bother with that. And do you feel like that's a change for the negative, that grammar has lost its protagonism a bit in curriculum, in a curriculum, for example? Or is it?
No, not really. I mean, if people can learn grammar through the back door, as it were, which I think is how kids learn English, don't they? Or learn languages. They don't really learn them consciously. They just acquire language somehow. And I guess if you can do that, then you have all the subconscious knowledge of the language, and you don't need to be able to analyze it consciously, I guess. It just comes down to interest. I mean, if you like deconstructing things and you find language interesting, then it's just a personal choice. I know that older learners generally love to kind of analyze grammar, and for some reason they see that as the way to learn a language. But I think children teach us every day that that's not the case.
I think in Spain, at least, the older generations would have learned a lot of grammar, reading English, but never would have spoken it. But now the focus has switched completely, and now kids are learning at a young age how to speak. They're learning phonetics. And as you mentioned, it's about absorbing it with that young, spongy mind and just speaking it naturally and knowing it intrinsically, no? That type of language. Another facet of you I would love to delve into is you as a writer. So can you tell us a little bit about your writing experience or your writing background?
Well, again, it probably initially sprang from an interest in words. So when I was in my early 20s, in fact, it was just around when I was in university, I read a book, Dharma Bums by Jack Kerouac. When I read that, it had such an impact on me. Because I could see that it was possible to be a writer and lead an interesting life as well. And so I thought that's the life for me. So I spent my 20s just going from job to job without any interest in any career at all. I just wanted to write. And so I did. And it takes a long time, perhaps, to get published. So I got things as well published here and there, the odd poem, the odd short story.
Means.
And it's something that at times I've tried to leave in my life, just thinking, well, what am I bothering to do this for? But I never managed to really leave it. It's just sort of there in the background, something I must do, not necessarily full time all day long, but. That's my story with writing.
I think that's fascinating that you mentioned that you traveled kind of around or went from job to job to serve your writing as such. And do you feel like the world has maybe caught up with you, because now traditional jobs 9 to 5 don't exist anymore. People talk about the gig economy and everybody has a side hustle, or, you know, they're doing this little bit here, a little bit there. And it's also fragmented. So the lifestyle that you kind of chose to lead has become a fact for a lot of people these days. So do you feel like that your kind of desires are being reflected by the reality of the world as it is today?
Objectively, there might be an element of that, although it doesn't really feel that way. Writing is a different thing depending on what you write about and why you do it. For me, it's a very sort of internal process. So it's part and parcel of wanting to look inside and spend a lot of time on my own or staring at sunsets or sitting under trees. It's all part of that experience. It's an extension of that. I don't know how many other people are like that, really. It seems to me that as I look around, most people want to be distracted away from themselves and distracted away from the internal world, whereas I want to delve into it. And even I would say that I kind of see that as reality, or my reality, and the wild world out there is somehow belongs to other people. Of course, that's not actually the case, but that's the way I experience it.
Okay. And speaking of Kerouac, is your writing in this style, this stream of consciousness? And like him, you talk about traveling. You mentioned it's more focused perhaps on your interior world. So how do you write? What is your style? How would you define it? And what would be like a typical scenario that you would write about then?
Yeah. I would define it as rubbish, basically. I'd love to write like Jack Kerouac. I mean, I think we often have literary heroes and then we try and mimic them. Mm-hmm. And we can do that for about 3 pages. And then we just can't keep up the facade any longer, or it's just too forced. So, I mean, no, I can't write like him, and I don't. It's a broad brush of things. I mean, I've written a comedy magazine, which sells on Amazon. I wrote that with a friend of mine.
Oh, wow.
Called Belly Up Magazine. And so that's just pure satire and absurdity. And then I write, you know, little poems. I've written quite a few novellas.
Nice.
And to sum them up, well, again, I guess it's to do with the inner experience. It's more existential than anything else. I'm not interested, you know, it's quite a bold claim, but I'm not really interested in story. I'm interested in the poetry, the images, and I'm interested in kind of individual moments. Because I often think in life that there are moments where you're sitting somewhere or you're outside and the light just hits the grass in a certain way, and the trees flicker in a certain way, and the sky is the right color. And there is something absolutely enriching about that moment. And if there's any way of capturing that, then that's what I try and do one way or another, either in long prose or just in poems. And then, of course, I write about utterly absurd things. Like one thing I wrote that did reasonably well was just a short flash fiction, which was called Funny House, which was just about a man who arrived back from work and was just sitting in his armchair, and he just started looking around at the objects in his house, finding them vaguely funny. And that grew and grew. And in the end, he was in utter hysterics at all the objects in his house, and to such an extent where he had to leave. So there's that interest in absurdity and anything surreal as well.
That's fantastic, the absurd element, but also it's so beautiful how you describe how you are compelled to capture these personal yet universal moments. And you're right, it is about how the light might hit off a leaf or a certain sensation or a certain color. And that is, I think, the foundation of great literature as well. And it's interesting what you say, because I do work with an editor on a magazine that's published maybe once a year. And all the short stories are big on description and the poetry of the prose. And the criticism he always gives me is like, and that it's too narrative, lose the narrative. I just want description. So I might have to go to you for a workshop in the future to do that.
I don't know about that.
And you mentioned you have a bit of, you know, things have done reasonably well. You obviously publish on Amazon. What's your relationship with your audience like? I mean, do you get emails or messages or comments from people that have read your work?
Yeah, I mean, not that many. But because I've never really expected to touch that many people, because it's really difficult. I mean, to get anything published is really difficult anyway, as you know. And it's the reason for having anything published, it usually is because it's got some sort of commercial success. And most of what I do, I don't think really could make that claim. But yeah, I do get nice emails, and I guess there's one, I can think of one story that might interest you in terms of my writing, is that again, with a friend of mine, we wrote a script, a comedy script, and we tried to get it made without any success. Then we found out where Terry Gilliam lives. He lives in Hampstead. I won't tell you anything more than that, but Hampstead in London. And we went up to his house, and there was no letterbox. We wanted to put the script into the letterbox with no letterbox, but there was this big, fairly intimidating black iron gate, and I just decided to throw it through. So I threw it through the gate, and it sort of sidled up to his doorway. We didn't expect to hear anything. I assumed it would just be put in the bin. But we got an email from him, and he'd read it, unbelievably. And not only had he read it, he loved it. And so he invited us for lunch. And so we were sitting there with Terry Gilliam, and he was telling us all about, you know, the pythons and you know, what goes on, what really went on. And he said at one point, "Your script is all I think about." He was so passionate about it. And we thought he was going to make it. And he came very close to doing that. But at some point, another project came along, or he pulled out for some other reason. But now, actually, it's inspired me, because I don't live that far away from a few other celebs. So, I mean, they're less important, perhaps. But there's George Clooney, who lives up the road. There's Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin. So I may well be paying them a visit and chucking things over their garden fences.
Ah, well, that's fantastic. I mean, I think you need sometimes just to open the door with something different than the traditional route. And once you get your foot in the door, and if the work is good enough, which yours clearly was, it can potentially lead somewhere, you know. I heard a story.
You never know, right?
Yeah. You never know, because I heard a story of a guy who dressed. He wanted to pitch a product to this businesswoman, and he dressed up as a courier and got into her office pretending he had a package, and then he just disrobed to his normal clothes. He had clothes underneath, and then he gave his business presentation. And even though I can't remember what the product was, she actually invested in it and it became relatively successful. So sometimes something different is what's called for. And, you know, earlier in our conversation, you mentioned Italy, you mentioned Madrid. And I know you grew up in a commune as well. So what can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, okay. So my parents were initially farmers, and I think my father had an argument with his brother because they shared the farm, and he just sort of stormed off with all of us one day. And we moved around the country, and he did a variety of other jobs, but was generally unsatisfied. Somehow, my parents heard of this commune, community, whatever we're calling it, in deepest Suffolk in England. And they used to go to meetings there, and eventually decided they wanted to move in. So they were vetted by the community members, and one day we went there. So I think I was 6 or 7, I'm not sure. And so we moved to this quite large estate. It's the centerpiece is an old Jacobean mansion. The history of the place, I think it used to be a public school for girls, and before that it was belonged to lords and who knows. I don't know the actual origins.
Yeah,
but it was an estate, and it was quite grand. It had a moat around the big house, and there were 365 lime trees for each day of the year.
Oh, nice.
And that was lovely. The people who were there were basically, there was, I guess you could call them hippies. So there was an element of hippies there. There was an element of people running away from the world who just couldn't make it, a bit like a TEFL teacher, really. And so running away, these outsiders, and a lot of them had psychological problems. So it wasn't uncommon to find that someone had tried to hang themselves in the barn or something.
Wow.
And then on top of that, there were a couple of nuns, because the money for the original community came from an order of nuns, a French order. So, and there were some families as well. So we all lived together, and we all had our own duties. As well as that, we had groups coming in to stay. I guess that was to make money. There was a farm, and there were some rare breeds, and my family's duties were to look after the land. So we spent most days, I mean, we went to a local school, but as soon as we came back from school, we were just outside doing our duties or in the community room, chatting with people or getting involved in a variety of activities. Mm-hmm. And that's the way we lived, fairly cut off from the outside world. So at school, you know, people would talk about what they did at the weekend and going out, and that was all completely foreign to us, because all we really knew was the community life there.
And did they, sorry.
Yeah. No, go for it.
And I was just going to say, I mean, did the commune eventually peter out and disappear? Or is there still something today that
right.
comes from that?
It turned into, I think it turned into a wedding venue or a hotel.
Okay.
Eventually. Although we left after 10 years. So my mother left anyway. So my parents got divorced.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just my father and us, we children there. And so one day he suddenly died. So as children, we weren't members of the community and couldn't be. So we had to leave and get into the real world.
Wow. I mean, that change must have been quite drastic for obviously the untimely bereavement, which is a very tough thing to deal with. And secondly, as you mentioned, you were cut off and suddenly you're thrust into this, well, into the modern world again. That must have been, was that a strange experience for you or a tough one?
I'm still dealing with it, Ender.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. The modern world. Yeah. no, I mean, So, yeah, it was. I mean, of course, much younger, so everything was an adventure, I guess. But I guess that upbringing had a huge impact on me because one of the things I noticed is that because it was a big, big house with lots of outbuildings and a lot of land, anything less than that feels odd to me. So just living in a house with four walls seems to me as like such a restriction.
Mm-hmm.
Because growing up, just sort of walking out the door, there's land there, walking over to somebody's house or walking around the big complex, mm-hmm. lots of people having access to lots of people. And not being there always feels like a constant wrong, like I've sort of limited myself in some way. And I've actually, because in TEFL, I've done many of these summer schools.
Mm-hmm.
And actually that oddly replicates that experience because you're thrown together with a lot of people in a residential setting. And it's usually an old public school or a university. You've got the complex, you've got land, you've got people. So I've kind of over the years got a measure of that by doing summer schools.
That's quite fascinating as well, because people do say that there's a loss of community in the modern world. You obviously had that sense of community. And then during the pandemic and the confinements, we had even less of community. And it was limited to appearing on balconies or maybe having a Zoom group chat or something like that. But also I wanted to ask you as well, do you feel like this experience or that experience in the commune today has given you something positive in the sense of you like collaborating with people, sharing things, that kind of ethos? Is there any kind of beautiful legacy that being there has given you that you still have today?
That's partly true about collaborating with people. I think it set me up on an alternative path through life. So as I say, the idea of just being married and having children and having professional aspirations and a career has never really felt right to me. So I haven't pursued that. And I don't know if that's nature or nurture. I don't know if the community experience bred that into me or whether mm-hmm. it was already me or whether it was a marriage of the two. But certainly growing up in that environment certainly perhaps set me up for a life a bit sort of on the periphery. And that experience I enjoy. So I guess you could say it has been a positive thing. I think also the kind of interest in community and the interest in being aware of how people are around you, because I think being in a community, you become aware if someone's having a bad day or if they need help. And whereas, for example, now I live in a block of flats and obviously I have neighbors, but we never speak to each other. I mean, not for the want of trying, but that's just the way people live in blocks of flats. even though we're next door to each other and someone might be going through utter hell, I would never know about it. And yeah, that doesn't seem right to me. So yeah, the idea of community perhaps has remained within me. Yeah.
Very good. And I guess the last thing I can ask you today is we've spoken about, you know, where you've come from and everything, and looking forward now, you mentioned, you know, you don't like to be tied to any type of goal perhaps, but with that in mind, is there anything that you want to do? Is there any place you want to see in the next few years, like maybe live somewhere else or write a particular type of thing or any experience that you want to have in the next, your future, really?
Let's see. Right. Well, it's always good to move around. I think most people get a lot out of traveling. I think if I look back anywhere I've ever been, anywhere I've ever traveled, I don't think I've ever regretted it. It's a bit of a hassle sometimes, you know, planning and deciding where you're going to go and actually, you know, making the effort to do it. But I've never regretted it. It's always renewing. And even just getting on the train, leaving Reading, for example, you know, it's just immediately I've got new perspectives on life. It sounds pathetic almost, but just, you know, 5 minutes down the road on a train and I see the whole of life differently, and I have a different outlook on my past and on the future and the world around me. So that experience is well worth cherishing and making happen. So any opportunity to travel, and in terms of you know, concrete locations, I've always had a hankering to go to Canada. So somehow there's something fresh in the air out there, at least in my imagination. The sky is slightly bluer and the green on the trees is slightly more vivid, etc. So who knows, maybe that's the next place.
Well, next time we speak, I hope we can hear the wind rustling through the pine trees in the Canadian wilderness. So Bill,
well, I could fake that sound if you like.
You probably put a Zoom background. Yeah. Convince me. Well, Bill, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. So full of insight. I really enjoyed hearing your story. I'm sure our listeners have as well. So a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being here today.
Lovely to meet you, Ender, and it's been a pleasure for me too. Thank you.
Okay, so that's a wrap for today. For the next episode, we'll have Maria back in the hot seat with me, and we'll talk about something cultural inside and outside Madrid.